good evening. Law enforcement says they're not sure of the motivations behind the Jersey City shootings, but Mayor de Blasio says the target is real.
We saw yesterday was a premeditated, violent, anti-Semitic hate crime. In other words, you can say it was an act of terror because it was premeditated, because it was violent, because it was directed at the Jewish community.
Law enforcement, the Department of Justice defends their decision to use the so-called Steele dossier to open up an investigation into Trump foreign policy, and there's a new bill to lower drug prices. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Wednesday, December 11th, 2019. Investigators are not sure why two people launched a deadly attack at a New Jersey kosher grocery store. Six people, including the two shooters, three civilians, and a police officer, died in a series of events that ended in a police shootout on Tuesday in Jersey City, New Jersey. Among the dead was the wife of the store owner, an employee, and a customer who is also the son of a prominent Brooklyn rabbi. New Jersey Attorney General Gerber Gruwall.
So here's what we know now. It's believed that at some point yesterday, two individuals encountered and killed Jersey City Police Detective Joseph Seals in the Bayview Cemetery in Jersey City. The two suspects are David N. Anderson, age 47, date of birth October 20th, 1972, and Francine Graham, age 50, date of birth April 28, 1969. Both of them are deceased. Thereafter, at approximately 12:21 p.m., a white U-Haul van driven by Mr. Anderson parked directly across the street from the J.C. Kosher supermarket, which is approximately 1 mile from the cemetery. Within seconds of arriving, Mr. Anderson exited the driver's side door of the U-Haul with a rifle in his hand. He walked towards the J.C. Kosher supermarket and immediately began shooting. Miss Graham, the passenger in the van, followed Mr. Anderson into the store. From that point on until the conclusion of the event, the two suspects remained inside the store. Inside the supermarket, the suspects encountered four civilians. Three of these civilians were killed, and one survived a gunshot wound. The survivor was able to escape the store at the beginning of the incident, and we are not providing his name at this time. At approximately 12:38 p.m., the Jersey City Police Department received a 911 call from an individual who discovered the body of Detective Seals. Minutes later, at approximately 12:43 p.m., Jersey City Police Department personnel arrived in the vicinity of the J.C. Kosher supermarket and engaged with the two suspects inside. A long, protracted shootout followed, and at approximately 3:25 p.m., a police-armored vehicle broke through the entryway of the supermarket. And at approximately 3:47 p.m., the law enforcement incident ended when the officers discovered the bodies inside the supermarket.
But at an emotional news conference from City Hall, Mayor Bill de Blasio said the motive behind the shooting was clear.
Moshe Deutsch, the son of Abe Deutsch, a well-known community leader in Williamsburg, was brutally murdered in this attack. Leah Ferenc, also originally from Brooklyn and from Jersey City. Detective Joseph Seals of the Jersey City Police Department brutally assassinated. A horrible, horrible attack. I want to ask for a moment of silence for all that were lost yesterday. We're here at a very somber moment. We're here at a very urgent moment for this city, but also for this nation. Everyone is here sharing that same mix of sorrow and anger and urgency. Members of the Jewish community have told me they no longer feel comfortable wearing anything that is a symbol of their faith for fear of an attack. That is absolutely unacceptable in a free society that anyone should have to feel that way from any faith, any background. It's unacceptable in a city that is meant to be for everyone and prides ourselves in respecting all people. It's a national problem, unquestionably, but it is here now, and we have to recognize that this is a crisis.
De Blasio added there's no specific threat targeting New York City, but he used the news conference to unveil a new division of the NYPD tasked with investigating groups advocating racial or ethnic hate.
At this hour are no credible and specific threats directed against New York City. But that is not sufficiently comforting, and that is why we are in a state of high alert. I directed the NYPD last night to go into that state of high alert and to ensure that hundreds of officers would be assigned to dozens of crucial Jewish community locations around the city. That effort will grow, and that effort will be ongoing. Commissioner Shea will go into detail. You will see visible and increased presence throughout the Jewish community for a number of days to come. That's the first point for people to understand. That presence will be large and consistent over the coming days. It has started already. Second point is the NYPD has been building a new unit. Over the last weeks, we now want to publicly announce this unit. The acronym is REME. That stands for Racially and Ethnically Motivated Extremism. The unit is focused on identifying any trends and any signs of racially and ethnically motivated extremism so that it can be acted on before any terror or any bias crime occurs. Commissioner Shea and Deputy Commissioner Miller will go into greater detail. This is a new unit within the NYPD's Intelligence Bureau. As I said, it has been built up over the last weeks. It did not happen as a result of this horrible incident yesterday, but this is the time to now talk publicly about the role of this unit and what it will do. And will directly take on the hate groups that are trying to spread in this country and that pose a threat to so many communities.
Mayor de Blasio, a law enforcement official speaking on condition of anonymity, tells the Associated Press that investigators are looking into possible connections between the attackers and the Black Hebrew Israelite movement. The organization is known for preaching conspiracy theories targeting Jewish people, has not been known for involvement in violence. And I, just as an aside, I would, repeating the police officials earlier today, not be so quick to make assumptions before the facts are in. And in news from Washington, President Donald Trump's Health Secretary Alex Azar and his Medicare chief Seema Verma are increasingly at odds, and their feuding has delayed the president's long-promised replacement proposal for Obamacare, a centerpiece to Trump's health care package. According to Politico, battle lines have formed among White House aides, with camps split between Verma and Azar, contributing to the stalemate. Azar has the backing of two of the administration's most powerful lawyers, while Verma has known Vice President Mike Pence for years and had a direct line to the president during talk of unveiling an Obamacare replacement. But House Democrats are moving ahead with their own new health care proposals, even as the White House is mired in infighting. Despite the House impeachment vote, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is setting a showdown vote this week on a Democratic House bill to lower prescription drug costs. Linda Perry reports.
New bill, it empowers Medicare to negotiate drug prices. It would use savings from lower drug costs to provide Medicare recipients with dental, vision, and hearing benefits, which aren't covered now. While the bill is expected to pass the Democratic-controlled House, it has little chance to pass the Republican-run Senate. While as a candidate, Donald Trump called for giving Medicare negotiating clout, he backed off, and now he's arguing that the plan keeps new drugs from the market. But the Democratic House caucus, which is led by New York Chair Hakeem Jeffries, made the case today for the bill. It's called the Lower Drug Costs Now Act.
There's no way the federal government should not have the ability to use its bulk price purchasing power to drive down the high price of life-saving prescription drugs. And that is what H.R. 3 will begin to accomplish. On behalf of the American people, it's transformative.
Jeffries says the change would save American taxpayers nearly $500 billion over the next 10 years. Florida Representative Donna Shalala, she's a Democrat from Florida and also former Secretary of Health and Human Services under Bill Clinton, points out how very outdated Medicare is.
With the exception of Medicare Part D, we haven't modernized the program since 1965. So adding hearing and vision and dental coverage to Medicare will be part of this package, as well as billions of dollars invested in the National Institutes of Health.
Shalala says we should join every other country on earth and allow our government to bargain for better prices for prescription drugs and put a cap on out-of-pocket expenses for Medicare recipients.
We've always been willing to subsidize poor countries. We're not talking about Africa or countries in Latin America here. But subsidizing England and France and Canada and Germany and Australia and Japan and Sweden and Norway and Denmark is not our responsibility. We are not their deep pockets. We should not be paying substantially more for the same medicines than people in those countries.
The Lower Drug Costs Now Act will be voted on in the House this week. In addition, New York Congressmember Yvette Clark and U.S. Senator from Massachusetts Elizabeth Warren announced the reintroduction of the National Biomedical Research Act. The bill would provide National Institutes of Health, the NIH, and the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, with predictable supplemental funding for biomedical research on the underlying basis of disease to better address disease prevention, diagnosis, and treatment, and also breakthrough research on diseases with unmet medical needs or for which current treatments are limited, inadequate, or burdensome. The bill would also provide money for research on chronic degenerative diseases that disproportionately contribute to spending under Medicare, Medicaid, and the Children's Health Insurance Program. Also, the grant would help young scientists and research institutions supporting these scientists, which lead to earlier research independence and enhance employment opportunities throughout the nation. This is Linda Perry, WBAI News. Back over to you, Paul.
Thank you, Linda. And you're listening to the news on listener-sponsored, locally produced, and independent WBAI in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Please take a moment to call our line, our pledge line, 516-620-3602. Make a pledge, become a WBAI buddy on behalf of the WBAI News. Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz faced the Senate Judiciary Committee to be grilled on his findings about the origins of the FBI's Russia probe in 2016. But while Horowitz said the investigation was legitimate, serious mistakes were made by the FBI. The hearings have to do with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act applications made by investigators. Known as FISA, the law allows warrantless wiretapping of targets and counterintelligence investigations. The investigation, known by its code name Crossfire Hurricane, targeted Carter Page. The FBI said it believed Page, who worked for the Trump campaign and was an advisor to President Trump on foreign policy matters, was cooperating with Russians to help the Trump campaign in 2016. DOJ Inspector General Michael Horowitz.
Find documentary or testimonial evidence that indicated political bias or improper motivation influencing his decision to open the investigation. While the information in the FBI's possession at the time was limited, in light of the low threshold established by Department and FBI predication policy, which, by the way, is not a legal requirement, but rather a prudential one in the FBI and Department policies, we found that Crossfire Hurricane was open for an authorized investigative purpose and with sufficient factual predication.
Horowitz said the requirements to launch a FISA investigation are so low as to have made it easy to begin investigating Page. In this case, the evidence used to begin the investigation came from the Steele dossier, prepared by counterintelligence expert Christopher Steele, who had been paid by the Democratic National Committee for his research. Much of the dossier contains salacious material about Trump's visit to Moscow and his attempts to meet with Vladimir Putin to open a Trump hotel in Moscow, a deal that never materialized.
FBI and department officials told us the Steele reporting, quote, pushed the FISA proposal over the line, close quote, in terms of establishing probable cause, and we concluded that the Steele reporting played a central and essential role in the decision to seek a FISA order. FBI leadership supported relying on Steele's reporting to seek a FISA order after being advised of concerns expressed by a department attorney that Steele may have been hired by someone associated with a rival candidate or campaign.
GOP Senator Lindsey Graham asked why the FBI was so quick to think the worst of Trump instead of protecting him from alleged foreign interference by treating Trump as a potential suspect in a crime from the beginning.
So my point is, if this is a counterintelligence investigation, who are they trying to protect? Who should they be trying to protect?
Well, if it's the threat outlined in the friendly foreign government information, you would be looking to protect the election process,
right?
Which would include
the candidate,
the campaign, the candidate, and the American people.
Okay, so did they ever brief Hillary Clinton about efforts to foreign influences involving her campaign? Do you know?
I've heard that, but I don't know for a fact.
They did. Good for them. And they stopped it. Was there ever a defensive briefing given by the FBI, the Department of Justice, to Donald Trump about the concerns?
There was not.
What would you call a counterintelligence investigation that never had a protective element?
I'm not sure. Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, if without eventually trying to protect the entity being influenced, is it legitimate?
It would depend on each fact and circumstance.
Here's what I'm trying to tell you.
Yeah.
If you're opening up a counterintelligence investigation to protect somebody, you should do it. Did they ever try to protect Donald Trump from foreign influence?
They did not brief him, and we lay out on page 55.
As a matter of fact, when they went in and gave a vanilla briefing, the Russians are out there, you better beware. Didn't they have an FBI agent do a 302 on the defensive briefing itself?
They sent one of the supervisory agents from the Crossfire Hurricane team to the briefing, and that agent prepared a report to the file of the briefing.
About what Trump said?
About what Mr. Trump said and what Mr. Flynn said.
Okay. So when we get defensively briefed tomorrow, would it be okay for FBI agents to open up 302s on what we said?
We have very significant concerns about that.
A 302 is an FBI investigative document used to document conversations that are then put into permanent files. It's the beginning often of an investigation into a person for a criminal matter. But Vermont Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy was interested in another issue, New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani's contacts with the FBI on behalf of Trump, where apparently Giuliani got inside information.
Rudy Giuliani and others appear to receive highly sensitive leaks from the New York FBI field office, leaks that likely contributed to Director Comey's public announcement that he was reopening the Clinton investigation just days before the election. I asked then-Director Comey about these leaks. He said he was investigating. Now, we know the number of these leaks to Mr. Giuliani, which he then ran to the cameras and actually bragged about talking about. What can you tell us about the New York field office's leaks? Mm-hmm. to Rudolph Giuliani and others.
So as we noted publicly last year in our report, we were very concerned about that. We put in the appendix charts showing all the different contacts. And subsequent to that report, and this continues to this day, we are investigating those contacts. We've issued a couple of public summaries so far about people we found violated FBI policy. We have other investigations ongoing that when we conclude that, we will also post summaries of. It's what's proving to be very hard is to prove the actual substance of the communications between the agents and the reporters or the individuals, as you might guess. But we can prove the contacts, and under FBI policy, you need authorization if you're going to disclose information and have certain contacts.
Thank you.
Then FBI Director Comey's reopening of the Clinton emails case on the eve of the 2016 election is credited with helping President Trump win. At a campaign event in Hershey, Pennsylvania last night, President Trump claimed the report by the Department of Justice Investigator General further exonerated him and proved FBI malfeasance in the investigation, statements not supported by today's testimony. And closer to home, in a recent speech to law enforcement, Attorney General Bill Barr says cops might withhold protection to communities that don't offer enough respect.
More than they do, the respect and support that law enforcement deserves. And if communities don't give that support and respect, they may find themselves without the police protection they need.
Activists in New York have proposed laws that would actually prohibit police from responding to certain situations dealing with emotionally disturbed persons. But Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams, who spoke a few days ago at WBAI, says that's not a realistic answer.
Police should be properly trained, but we cannot romanticize when a person is acting in a behavior or manner that is a danger to himself and others. To send a mental health professional to a person who's violently, emotionally disturbed, to send them without some type of police reinforcement because it sounds good, that is not right. I've responded to emotionally disturbed people who were violent. And let me tell you something, it is not an easy thing to de-escalate. And if you don't have someone that's trained to use the methods of restraint, you could harm yourself and you could harm that person. So it's always good to look outside and say, hey, we should just go to the person who's emotionally and violent and just hug them. That is not a reality. In the real world of dealing with emotionally violent individuals, you better be well trained and you better be able to restrain them.
In another story, the borough president spoke with WBAI about the night he spent outside advocating for the homeless. There was a worldwide sleep out in support of homeless people. Adams says the solution to the homeless crisis is in communities' response.
People sent us photos from Harlem and from parts of Queens. So there were other groups that were doing what we did at Brooklyn Borough Hall. We slept out on the steps of the Borough Hall. The people were sleeping in other locations.
What has changed now that has gotten the attention of enough of your attention to want to sleep out to make a point about that?
I don't believe there has ever been a time that homelessness was something that we got used to. It was really about it's time for us to be more socially conscious and deal with the fact that we have close to 64,000 homeless people, more homeless than the Great Depression. 110,000 approximately are school-age children who are living on someone's sofa or in a shelter. And so this is a real moral issue. If we say over and over again that home is where the heart is, then it is extremely heartless that we have a city where thousands of people don't have a home. And so it's about how do we engage in our space. And some people will look and say, well, sleeping out is just symbolic. Hey, it's the accumulation of actions. You know, Rosa Parks not sitting in the back of the bus would have been perceived to be symbolic. Dr. King marching over the Pettus Bridge would have been symbolic. But it's an accumulation of symbolic issues and actions that allows us to draw in the consciousness of people to say, let's stop walking past homeless people and let's engage with them in a real way. Let's buy socks, T-shirts. Let's invite them to our houses of worship.
What could possibly be done?
I think that's where we fault and where we differ. I differ with a lot of people. Political leaders are still citizens of the city. I have homeless on my block also. It's what we do as a city. I put money into a shower bus, a couple $100,000, so that we could allow people who are homeless to take showers. We have put about $2,000, $3,000 into van to give them haircuts. You know, I volunteer my time with the homeless. But we can't do this alone. We need everyone engaged. And it's not about just, well, what is the local politician is going to do? It's what's the local citizen going to do? And that is where we go wrong. We are looking for others to solve a problem that's universal. And so we're doing what needs to be done on our part. This is not the first time I slept with a homeless. I slept in a synagogue that rents out its space. They don't look for money from the city. They use their free space to allow homeless people to sleep in their basement area for free. We have countless number of churches that are not open during the week. We have countless numbers of mosques and synagogues. Why can't we open the doors to these churches and allow people who are homeless to occupy these spaces? In addition, government does have a responsibility, particularly for street homeless, which are really individual mental health issues for the most part. Got to give them wraparound services. Allow them to take the proper medications and give them the support that is needed. So it's a combination of government and citizens that's going to solve this homeless problem.
What was it like that night? It was a cold night, huh?
It was cold. I was coming off a flu. I did not want to be out there, but I had an option. Too many people don't have an option. Mm-hmm. And too many people will look at Eric Adams sleeping out or the hundreds of people that slept out of Times Square and say, we're not doing a lot, or CUNY sleeping out. Those CUNY students that joined me, they would say, well, you know what, you guys are not doing a lot. But you know what? They're not doing anything at all. So before the first action of dealing with homelessness is to take that real peek at the person you see in the morning in the mirror, we all need to ask a question. What are we doing about the homeless problem? Mm-hmm. And we can't kick the can down the road.
The mayor wasn't out there, was he, in any of these places?
No, he was not of my knowledge. And I think that our city government could do a better job. And the question mark lingers over our city. Where's our humanity? And I said we can find it in our activity. Go volunteer. We volunteered at the Best Eye Against Hunger, where countless number of people were in need. This is a real issue for me. I experienced almost had homelessness several times as a young man. And it was everyday people during that time who came and assisted my family. And where are those people?
Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, December 11th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From the studios of listener-sponsored, locally produced, and independent WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.